Okay, here with gubernatorial candidate Rod Roberts. Representative Roberts, you've kind of had a tough, you know, start of the week with a blog post actually came out Friday regarding the interview you had with the Des Moines Register editorial board, and discussion was about a statement made by you regarding moral law and what encompasses moral law. And I'd just like to give you a chance to clarify some of the statements that you made. I know you had other chances yesterday, but what is the basis of moral law? How would you define that? And use the quote with me earlier before we started recording from Blackstone. I'd like you to share that as well.
Thank you, Shane. There's a wonderful quote that is actually an important historic statement that is found inside the rotunda on the main floor of the state capitol in Des Moines. And it's a quote attributed to Blackstone, the 17th century British judge, often referred to as one of the, if not the fathers of common English law, and certainly in Western civilization, that's a significant cornerstone to how we approach a philosophy about law and lawmaking. But the quote is, law, with a capital letter L, meaning the body of law, law is the embodiment of the moral sentiment of a people. So in other words, I've never subscribed to the theory that you debate and make public policy or law in a moral vacuum. That there is always this tension and this struggle between individuals and groups of people over whose moral point of view will prevail when laws are made. So there may be an issue that develops where there is a policy discussion and debate, and then you have to make a decision in casting a vote on a proposal, and you always filter that decision through your personal lens or frame of reference. Is that good or bad? Is that moral or immoral? Just or unjust? Every decision has some degree of morality associated with it. Some outcomes I consider to be moral. Other outcomes, that's immoral.
Okay.
And it's, you find this constant struggle, and whichever point of view prevails will then determine with the public at large, I agree with that. That's a good law, it's moral. Or, I don't agree with that. I think it's immoral to some degree or another. And I'd work to change it.
Okay.
So, the other day when we had this editorial board interview with the Des Moines Register, the initial conversation came out of the discussion about the state of Arizona's immigration law. And the point being that I believe the people of Arizona have the right through their elected officials and the legislature and the governor to say, we need to deal with this problem. We want you to. And they did what they believed was in the best interest of the people of Arizona, given the circumstances Arizona is in. I support them in doing that because the federal government has been unwilling to deal with this problem. Someone then injected, well, a candidate who came through here before said that no, our response to this kind of situation should be in the lesson of the Good Samaritan, the story in the Bible, a very different approach to the problem. And I said, well, but if the people of Arizona say this is how we need to address it, notwithstanding the lessons of the Good Samaritan, that's the law. And that will be the moral application of the law dealing with illegal immigration in Arizona will be what that statute says. Maybe different in Iowa, because we would approach the problem given our unique circumstances. We deal with it, and the governor and the legislature working together, as they did in Arizona, we'd come up with a proposal to deal with the issue. In Iowa, our law might be different, but here it'd be moral because the will of the people will have been expressed through their elected officials, and some will agree with it, some will disagree and say, no, I think that's a shade of moral, or perhaps that's immoral.
Okay, so when you say moral, you're not using that necessarily from a Judeo-Christian point of view, and that moral is that we all have morals.
A belief system. An ability to say right, wrong, good, bad.
Okay. Well, I like it when people have said to me before, it's like, you can't legislate morality.
We do.
Yeah, absolutely. Any law passed is legislating morality. It just depends on whose morality you're legislating. legislating.
And I've heard legislators say, I don't wish to impose my morality. And it's like, you know, that's a cop-out.
Mm-hmm.
Because any vote you cast, whether it's what you personally express, you know, as an individual or not, you're going to impose something on people that will become a standard of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And it will have a moral connotation to it. I may not like it. I might consider that to be immoral. But the problem is it has a moral basis, and we're making a judgment call on what's moral and what isn't.
Okay. Now, in your mind, can a law, even a law passed by a popular vote, be ever, in your mind, considered immoral
yes.
or unjust?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think of any circumstances?
In my mind, same gender, same-sex marriage is immoral. If that was the law, I would consider that to be immoral. I think taking the life of the unborn is immoral. If that's the law, I'd work to change it. But the question and the challenge is always about that issue of morality.
Mm-hmm.
But a law can be immoral.
Okay.
So, in terms of just, you know, how you perceive and how you would react to that law isn't right.
Okay. So we have, you know, our morals, but in your, do you believe that there is a higher moral standard?
Yes, absolutely.
Moral law? Okay.
Yeah. In my life, there's no question, because I hold to a Judeo-Christian worldview, and I said that the other day.
Okay.
And I do. That's my frame of reference. In the interest of full disclosure, if I tell you my frame of reference and worldview is shaped with that Judeo-Christian standard of belief and understanding reality, that will influence how I view issues and how I view laws. Mm-hmm. And I will make a judgment based on my Judeo-Christian worldview, always. But in the arena of lawmaking, it's all about morals.
Okay.
Just like what Blackstone said, it's mm-hmm. the very thing. But in a public arena, when you live in a society like ours, where everybody participates in the marketplace or arena of ideas and mm-hmm. thought, which is where lawmaking takes place, you have to compete with all the other moral points of view
mm-hmm.
and work to see that your view prevails
okay.
on an issue.
Yeah.
So I work to do what I think is moral mm-hmm. and try to react to and defeat and stop what I consider immoral.
Okay.
That others believe is moral.
Okay.
That's why they're
so
advanced.
Just looking at Rod Roberts, the individual, mm-hmm. the core of your being, you know, your worldview, there are people that were trying to pigeonhole you into being almost sounding like you're kind of, you know, finger up in the wind, moral relativist.
Yes.
Well, this is...
No.
Can something be... Do you believe in absolute truth?
Yes.
And how would you define that?
For me, absolute truth, especially when it comes to the revelation in the Bible, Old and New Testament, I believe that the scriptures contained in the Old and New Testaments are in fact inspired words meant to be God's revelation to man in written form. What's there? Those represent to me absolute truth. Other things in the natural world are absolute truth. Gravity, you know, laws of nature, you know, that we know these things exist.
Mm-hmm.
So there is absolute truth.
Okay, so there's truth that could be true for all people, all places, all time.
Correct.
Okay, all right. Yep. Just wanted to...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, because I've never subscribed to it. We make it up as we go. I've never believed that at all.
Well, I've heard people, it's like, well, you know, if you're sincere about that, if you believe it, then it's true for you. And it's like,
yes.
My belief makes it true. Our belief doesn't make something true, correct?
Yeah. You may perceive it that way, but it doesn't make it so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Great. That's another way of describing that. Exactly. You can tell yourself all you want. It doesn't necessarily make it so, but in your reality, you say, I think it is. All right. But sun's still going to come up in the morning. It's still going to set.
Two plus two is still four.
Four. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Talk about, you had a conversation yesterday on WHO radio about gay marriage ruling mm-hmm. and in context of what, you know, the interview that you had, you talked about in the Des Moines Register editorial, if the people pass, if say we do get the opportunity to vote on a marriage amendment and the people vote it down.
Correct.
You'd said in that interview, that's it. What did you mean by that?
Given the current struggle, and I think that's what this is all about right now, this current response to the Supreme Court's ruling a year ago, April 3rd, 2009. We are now in a period of very important and I think strategic history in Iowa where this question is very clearly in my mind a question the people of Iowa want to weigh in on, because I honestly believe if that question is put to a vote of the people, they will uphold and affirm traditional marriage, one man, one woman. And whether I'm a citizen, a state representative, or the governor of Iowa, I will strongly advocate that that be passed, because marriage is, by definition, for me, whether it's through statute, which we have on the books, that's what Iowa's law says, natural law, male, female, God's law says, one man, one woman. That's what I believe, and I would advocate strongly for it. However, the very fact you'd put the question up for a vote implies there are two possible outcomes. I think the people will vote yes, but there will be people who vote no. And the question is, which prevails? I think the majority will side with and support traditional marriage.
So far, track record 31 for 31.
Yes.
Every time this gets put up for voted.
And that, to me, represents the culmination of this current struggle, because I believe that the people will affirm it. If they voted no, you'd have to go back to square one. What does this mean here in Iowa?
Okay. And what do you think that, looking at just, I've been thinking a lot about evangelicals in this debate and how we've engaged. You were accused yesterday of being a defeatist,
surrendering.
If this were to go back to square one, as the church, where do you think we go from here?
I think that raises a very important issue that we need to have a discussion about among evangelicals, and that is historically the role of churches and government in America has been one where churches engage in the public arena, influencing people, how they think, shaping ideas, philosophies. That's always been a healthy relationship between the community of faith and our, whether you call it, I hate to use the word secular, but just the structure of government, the public arena. I think the church needs to re-engage itself in this whole process of engaging culture at a local grassroots level, where churches see themselves as agents that are willing to get involved in people's lives and share their faith in a way that influences the way others think about reality.
Okay.
With a Judeo-Christian worldview that we all hold to, I think the call of the church today is engage culture here in America, begin to have influence, be the salt and the light that we're called to be, so that we can change the hearts and minds of people.
Yes, because in your 10 years of being a state representative, have you ever seen politics transform a heart?
No.
Okay.
No. You know why? And in fact, I was at a school before I arrived here today, and we talked about the anti-bullying law.
Okay.
And I asked the students, I said, now, we have a law in the books in Iowa that says it's illegal to bully someone. Has that stopped all the bullying here within the school? No. So why is that? But we have a law in the books that says you can't bully. Well, it's not enforced, or they don't take it to the final. I said, oh, so that hasn't changed the nature of some people. They're still going to bully. The law didn't change them. Nope. I said, that's interesting, because that raises an important question. What does the law do? It imposes a penalty, but it doesn't change and transform the heart or the inner person.
Absolutely.
And how they react.
Well, just looking at scripture, talking about God's law, all the law does is condemn.
Look at the children of Israel. They knew what the law said.
Yeah.
Look how often they wandered away from it and suffered the consequences. But there's that element within man's nature that says, I know what the law says, but I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
It's that piece of this that I think the church should realize, we got to talk about what's on the inside of people, the hearts and minds of people. And the example in the New Testament, whether it's the early disciples or people like the Apostle Paul, they understood it was important to engage culture.
Absolutely.
And influence people one-on-one. That's where we need to focus.
Yeah. Do you think talking about this in terms of culture war is helpful or hurtful?
I think it's hurtful in terms of trying to win people on the basis of reason, because the impression you give people is you're like a crusader, you're an enemy.
Yeah.
If I don't agree with you, you see me as an enemy. A wall is built when you use words like that. And it's not a comfortable, natural, given flow of ideas. It's I'm defensive now because I view you as threatening.
I'm just, reminded again to scripture. It says, our enemy isn't flesh and blood.
Mm-hmm.
We have spiritual enemies. And you know, I think, we've used the phrase, and I've used it myself and have been guilty of not doing this, that, love the sin, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we say that, but we really haven't done that very well.
Yeah.
And when this ruling came down, a little over a year ago, I was interim pastor down in Indianola and had a chance to talk to my congregation and recognize that, God's still on his throne. He's sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't done the best job influencing culture. Because if we had been salt and light, if we had been making an impact with the gospel, I would submit that we probably wouldn't be in this boat today.
I agree.
But God has a plan, and
And truth remains the truth.
Absolutely.
Marriage is still one man, one woman, mm-hmm. no matter what the court ruled. And our struggle is now, if in terms of the public arena, we want that to prevail, even by way of a civic code or policy, then we've got to go back to square one. How do we accomplish that? And I contend for the church, it's about re-engaging culture at the mm-hmm. grassroots, the person-to-person level.
Mm-hmm.
We'll let the public policy arena, run the course of going through process and procedure dealing with this, but long term, we should be very concerned about where our culture is.
Mm-hmm.
And the best agent for change with culture is the church.
Absolutely, and mm-hmm. that affects how people vote ultimately,
yes.
and affects the outcome at down the state house. So,
mm-hmm. I can add one more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it concerns me that if you take the generation, I'll just say 40 years old and younger. It's frightening to me how many people think this is no big deal. This thing about marriage, it matters to a lot of people 50, 60 and over. But what does that say to the church?
Hmm.
And there's no amount of effort in lawmaking that will impose something, again, a moral will that in time that people say, I don't agree with that. That's now immoral that you say it can only be one man, one woman. That struggle will continue. Unless the church engages in this whole idea of impacting and influencing culture, what I see coming mm-hmm. doesn't bode well for one man, one woman marriage.
Yeah, with younger evangelicals,
Yes, even within the evangelical community. Mm-hmm. And it's stunning how widespread that thinking is.
It's literally, and I know this is outside of purview of politics, so I want to make this very clear.
Yeah. Self.
Representative Roberts is running for governor, not theologian-in-chief of
right.
Iowa.
Good. Thank you. I had to make that distinction last night, too, because I think that's important. Remember, it might be my background, but I am running for public office.
Yeah. A lot of times I've seen as a youth pastor, and I've been in youth ministry, almost 18 years now. What I see within the church is a lot of biblical illiteracy with young people.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't know the scripture, how can they articulate mm-hmm. and form a worldview?
Correct.
So we got a lot of work to do as church.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. And there is, the good thing in America is there's always been a place and a role respectful of the church and its influence in society. We shouldn't let that slip away, or we shouldn't dismiss that. We need to make the most of it. Mm-hmm. And again, engage culture, because it's unique to America that we've been able to do this.
Okay. Want to go back to, yesterday afternoon, I told you I didn't get to listen to the whole conversation. We got mm-hmm. to listen a little bit about the back and forth between you and Steve Dace and,
yes.
and Brian English of Iowa Family Policy Center about the executive order.
Mm-hmm.
you know, you contend, okay, the Iowa Supreme Court struck down DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, but you believe that's still law that's on the books because the legislature has enacted
the law.
So you, in your role, if you were to, you know, win the nomination and win the general election, become our next governor, what role would you play in the whole scheme of things? How would you, and I think Steve's word was enforce the law that's on the books, even though it's been set aside by the court. Vanderplaat's campaign, and we've talked about this before, they put forth executive order idea. You disagree with that. So what would you as a governor do in the midst of this mess we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think the proper response of the governor is to give a formal statement that comes out strong in support of traditional marriage and let people know that I intend to try and gauge the legislative branch of government to see if there is a way we can address what the court has said in its ruling, because we have a law that's on the books that they have now said is unconstitutional. Why did they rule it that way? Is there something we can respond to legally that addresses the issue of the court and what it's raised in its ruling? And I think, in all fairness, is there some way that the legislative branch can take up the question of how far can the Supreme Court go in making a ruling like this that essentially sets aside the law and its effect?
Sorry to cough. Toward the tail end of the General Assembly, you had put forth, I think it was one bill regarding addressing Supreme Court issues. You want to talk a little bit about that?
In fact,
that was interesting.
One thing we should talk about is that here in Iowa, because we use a method of appointment and confirmation of our justices to the Supreme Court, in the November general election, there will be a retention election on the ballot where three of our current seven justices are up for retention. That's the one moment the people of Iowa have a direct say in who serves on their court. And if the people of Iowa say no in that question of retention to one, two, or three, perhaps all of the justices, including the Chief Justice herself, it will then set, to me, a very strong precedent in terms of the people's reaction to what a court has done, how it's ruled, which is the most powerful action that could take place in this whole matter. Even the proposal to use an executive order would not equal what I think would be the powerful statement made by the people themselves. As I've contended, the Supreme Court is not accountable to the governor. The governor doesn't keep the court in check. The people do. And that's the moment they could do that, which then opens the possibility of appointing new justices to the court.
Yeah, let me talk about or ask you a question about that, because in the Constitution, we kind of have an interesting system. It's not like, you know, at the federal level, where the president, well, obviously he's got a committee of people he appoints to look at nominees, but you actually, the governor has to appoint a committee, and then the governor, if I understand the Constitution correctly, has to accept recommendations, or at least one of the recommendations made by that committee, and can't consider anything outside of that committee. And if I remember this correctly, I'd have to reread it. I could be wrong. If you don't make that, if the governor doesn't make that appointment within 30 days, maybe it's a little bit longer than that, the Chief Justice can go ahead and fill that empty slot. My question would be, is, you know, what if you are given choices that none of them are palatable to you?
I would prefer having the freedom to be able to make my own selection and not be limited to what a committee's recommendation says.
Okay.
And there was a bill introduced that basically would set that system aside and allow the governor the freedom and the latitude to make his or her choice.
Okay, so that's not That's not a constitutional standard? I thought that was right in the Constitution.
It may have been a proposed amendment. It was still in bill form.
Okay.
It's still a bill. If a constitution...
Oh, gotcha.
See what
so
I'm
it'd
saying?
Be a
It has to be a legislator
amendment.
Who introduces
gotcha.
That.
Gotcha, okay.
Even if it's a resolution to amend the Constitution, it requires a legislator to introduce the bill.
I wasn't That's tracking with you. I was just thinking, okay. I was just thinking you
See,
know, something...
words matter.
I was just thinking like it was just a regular law for the Iowa Code.
Let me clarify.
Yes, okay, all right. Because I know, for instance, looking at a different state, somebody I'm a big fan of, Sarah Palin, faced the same issue when she was governor of Alaska,
mm-hmm.
had two choices. Neither were really palatable to her, but she chose what she thought would be the best, looking mm-hmm. at what could mm-hmm. potentially be the legal issues of her state.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious. So if we can't get that change in the Constitution, you put between a rock and a hard spot. What do you do as governor when you're faced with two choices that neither which necessarily mesh up to either a constitutional point of view or your Judeo-Christian point of view?
Of course, you'd want to have a say in who's constituting that committee.
Absolutely.
So that's how I would be very thoughtful and very careful in who would be bringing the recommendations
mm-hmm.
to me.
Isn't there, again, I look, but I remember there's a, in something in there, it says at least part of the membership has to be made up of Bar Association
yes.
members.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But I think the governor would have some latitude to express, their sentiment about this is who I would like to see
okay.
offered. And hopefully, that's respected. But ultimately, I think there's another area that you could certainly change what's there and maybe make it more independent of others saying this is the select limited pool you may choose from, because I think it would only be fair that the governor have the greatest latitude possible
mm-hmm.
in being able to say, I think this is the best person, regardless of what some committee's opinion that has other influences at play. Now that's one of those things you'll have to wrestle with in the public policy arena.
Mm-hmm.
The legislation I had sponsored this last year that went to the question of the structure of the Supreme Court would make the following changes. We have 8 judicial districts in the state of Iowa. And so my proposal was to increase the number of justices from 7 back to 9, which it was just very recently. And you would have one appointment come from each of those geographic areas of the state.
Okay.
It would almost be a residency requirement for a justice.
Okay.
With one at large.
Okay.
So that you would have justices like legislators who actually lived among the people.
Okay.
Because the tendency is once appointed and confirmed, you're pretty well set.
Yeah.
And then what do? A lot of people just move to Des Moines and here they live together.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that Des Moines isn't a great place. The idea, though, the court should represent all Iowans. I think there's value to the idea of I go to church with, I go to these school functions with, mm-hmm. The people I grew up with and I've lived with.
Yeah.
And you have this interaction with the grassroots citizens of the state to whom you are accountable because it's their Supreme Court.
Absolutely. Like the federal Supreme mm-hmm. Court, they're not in session all the time.
Right.
So why does their
Same
state?
Same here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just like
Makes
legislators
sense.
Have to travel to do their work together. So that'd be a hard... No, it's not, because it's about the people. And mm-hmm. it's about doing the very best job representing them, even if your role is that of a justice on the court. That's why I did that. Because I think we should reexamine a lot of different aspects of the court. Because I feel like in this ruling on marriage, somehow there was a great disconnect between the court, meaning those 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the court is a human organism.
Yeah.
And where the 3 million or the rest of us live.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? And I just think that's a practical issue that we should address, and that was why I introduced that legislation as a means of trying to keep the court connected to the people at the grassroots level in every area of the state.
Okay. Just a follow-up question regarding executive order.
Mm-hmm.
They've been making a lot of of noise about they in that the Vanderplas campaign and IFPC that the governor is the chief magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow that gives you extraordinary amount of authority over
everyone. I don't agree.
Okay, so the governor doesn't have authority over county recorders who issue the marriage licenses. So in effect, the executive order would do pretty much nothing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the response that you've even seen to this point, that the response has been that the court's ruling has had an effect at the local county government level. The governor doesn't have that direct say. I think the executive order, if I understand the way that's being presented, would give the governor significant authority and power, we should use the word power in association with authority here,
mm-hmm.
over nearly all the other components of the legislative, judicial branches. The governor already has great power over the legislative branch with the veto.
Yeah.
And now we're saying that one person also has, in effect, the same kind of authority, power over the judiciary. I don't see that that's what the founders intended mm-hmm. with this. I believe that no one person, regardless of their philosophy about governance, should have those kinds of strong powers at their disposal.
Okay. We talked a little bit about what could be what tangible things a governor could do. We talked about, you know, working with the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other things that a governor possibly could do other than, you know, the bully pulpit?
Certainly, as you described it, the first impulse that I would have is to engage the General Assembly, the mm-hmm. legislature, which should always be acknowledged as the lawmaking body. It's not the court, it's not the executive. The legislative branch makes law.
Mm-hmm.
To immediately bring up the question of what has the court done, is there a way that we can respond that I can be supportive of the legislative branch saying, then we will address this issue of concern or objection by the court, or I think long term we can have an open discussion about procedures and process. Is there some historic precedent perhaps for the legislature having maybe authority to be able to address a court decision that asserts, no, we do have final say?
Okay.
Not in the executive, but in the legislative.
Sure. Now, would you call the General Assembly back into special session?
Yes, okay. I would. If we were not in session, which a year ago we happened to be,
yeah.
when the court gave its ruling, mm-hmm. but I would call the legislature back into special session immediately if a ruling like that came down, because it's a significant significance to where I think we should have an immediate special session and discuss this formally.
Okay, and looking at the people who, you know, do, since people wouldn't go to the governor's office to apply for a marriage license, they go to the county recorders.
Yes.
And if a county recorder did refuse to give a marriage license to a homosexual couple, would you as a governor provide clemency or a pardon?
If that individual, because of conscience sake, said, I cannot do this, my conscience prevents me from doing something like this, given my worldview, I understand what they're saying and where they're coming from. If the stage was set and somebody over a religious conscience objection said, I can't, and somebody then took legal action, if it came to the place where that individual was actually was convicted of that, then the governor does have the power of pardon or clemency that could be extended.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be very responsive to someone whose circumstance said, I can't follow through with this, I can perform all the other functions, but as a matter of conscience and a First Amendment right,
mm-hmm.
I can't do that. And if they were actually charged and convicted, I would certainly consider my authority as governor to extend clemency.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then the good thing is, then locally, people can decide, we like that recorder for what they've done. Or, shame on you, you're out.
Yeah.
And I like that too, because it makes what, that county official accountable to whom? The people.
Yeah.
This has always been about the people with me.
Okay. I just want to give you a chance to, any final thoughts or comments that you'd like to make, or maybe something you'd like to have said but didn't get a chance to, or I didn't ask the right question.
Well, I just want to clearly affirm Rod Roberts believes that marriage is one man, one woman. Why? Not only because the statute in the code of Iowa says so, not only because natural law affirms one male, one female, procreate, etc. More importantly, God's word, his law says marriage is one man, one woman. From the very opening chapters to the book of Genesis, where we have the story of how man was created, it's clear, one man, one woman. That's what I believe. That's what I will support. If in fact that spiritual law is challenged and threatened, I will do everything I can to advocate within the bounds of what is legal and constitutional to defend that and advance that. And I'm open to anything that is available to me, but I will not say that I just believe and I assert myself over everyone else and all the other constitutional provisions and processes because of what my belief is. I will have to abide within the framework of how I would serve as governor.
And, you know, and what the Constitution allows. You know, another thought just came to mind too, is like, the governor doesn't have authority over the Attorney General.
Right. And you can request.
You can request, but I'm not sure how well I like that. Mm-hmm. When it goes my way, I guess I would. But if it, you know,
that's like the question of a governor's use of an executive order. So long as it's my guy and I like him,
yeah.
But
yeah.
What's good for one, and yeah. The tide changes, and now they can use it too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Good to give you a chance to go on the record. And
thank you.
Set the record straight and clarify. And
well, it's important to be clear because I consider this to be a paramount issue of concern that should be of concern to all Iowans. I believe Iowans are paying attention, but words matter, and I know what I mean. But when you're in a setting like we have today, it's important to be clear. And again, the other day, that setting was such where there was not the opportunity to be as clear as I would like to be, mm-hmm. because of the give and take of the nature of that kind of an interview process. And had someone followed up and asked, now, is this what you meant? I'd have been very clear, just like I have been here, but nobody asked.
Yeah, they're on a different subject.
They're on a different subject, and people have a different, how should I call it? They have a different angle they'd like to develop and mm-hmm. pursue, and they weren't real concerned at that point with what I might add to the conversation. But certainly, I want to be clear, and I think I have been.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Shane.